I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for.
Patricia T. O'Connor is here. She is the author of at least four books on the English language and also is the keeper of the Grammophobia.com website. And she visits us on a regular basis to talk about language and related matters. And I understand that you were inspired for this show by the fact that we have just had a major anniversary for World War I.
Yes, well, a lot of major anniversaries are coming up on the 28th of this month. It's the anniversary of the actual declaration of war.
We had the assassination earlier.
In June, yeah, on the 28th. That's the anniversary of Austria-Hungary's declaration of war against Serbia. And then in the following week, everyone else declared war on everyone else. So that it all happened so quickly.
And you noted that a lot of words that we still use actually came into prominence during that war.
Yeah. When you think about the First World War, I mean, it was a first in many respects. It was, you know, devastating in a way that war had never been before. But also, there were deadly new weapons, new ways of waging war, and consequently, unfortunately, new ways of suffering. So there were new words for all of these things. And some of these remained terms of war. A lot of them became, you know, became defunct. Well, Zeppelin, we don't think much about Zeppelins anymore.
But we still say blimp. And then we have a phrase like a war of attrition, which came out of World War I.
Yes, it did. And a lot of phrases came out of World War I that we still associate with World War I, but some lived on to have other applications. For instance, D-Day, a lot of people associate D-Day with the Normandy landings in World War II. Actually, D-Day was just the military term for the day an operation is to begin. The D stood for day. And the first D-Day was in September 1918, when the Allies mounted their offensive in the Argonne Forest, which was pretty much beginning the end of World War I.
Now, a word like ace, which was associated with the new airplanes.
Right.
Why ace rather than another word? Is it connected with to the cards?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the original etymology, that the ace was a one spot. It was a one and only. It was the top. And ace had long been used, actually, for anyone who was outstanding at something. But during World War II, it was first used to mean a flyer who, a pilot or a gunner or whatnot, who downs a lot of planes. And usually there was a certain number in whatever group he was in that he had to down to have a, you know, to be named an ace. Nothing official about it. But, yeah, there were a lot of flying terms.
First of all, for example, I learned that is taxiing on the runway, to taxi on the runway, comes out of World War I.
Now, that I didn't know.
And isn't that interesting that we have the word taxi?
Sense. Yes, and taxi was around then. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Another one, trench coat, the British.
Trench coat, exactly.
And we're still wearing trench coats.
Yes, the trench coat was a military item. It was first recorded in 1914 when it meant a lined or padded waterproof coat worn in the trenches. And when you look at old pictures of World War I officers in trench coats, you could wear those coats today.
They're very fashionable.
They look just like Burberry's.
Yes. Well, they were British.
Yes.
What are some of the other ones that that are just so much a part of our normal parlance that we don't associate them with World War I? Or?
Well, here's one, to zero in, meaning it originally meant to line up just your rifle sights, bring someone into your rifle sights. And now, of course, we don't think of it as a military term at all. The same with zero hour. Mm. Zero hour was the hour at which something will begin, and now we use it for ordinary applications. Now, this is an interesting one. Liaise, the verb liaise. I get mail a lot from people who say, oh, I just heard someone use liaise as a verb. Isn't this outrageous? Well, actually, liaise was first recorded in World War I, and it was British military slang for to make a liaison with. This kind of word is called back formation. I've talked about those before. You drop part of a word to make a new one. And the interesting thing about liaison, which it comes from, is that liaison, believe it or not, came into English as a cooking term. Its ultimate root is the Latin verb for to bind, ligare, to bind. And it came into French where it became liaison, the noun, meaning an agent for binding sauces, usually with egg yolk. Trust the French, I mean, a word for sauces. And that came into English as a cooking term, and eventually liaison became a joining of two people.
Did the English make that connection, or was that something the French were doing? Because
English
we have taken
it.
So many wonderful words from the French, camouflage being another one.
Yes, and camouflage.
And that's a World War I word.
Well, camouflage, the noun, was a word before World War I, but in World War I it became used for the first time as a verb, to camouflage something.
And that's a French word that
yes.
is
right.
the English were using in that way.
Yes, yes. But some other words that we use in an ordinary way now, tailspin, that came out of World War I aviation. A tailspin was an uncontrolled spinning descent when a plane lost its engine.
Nosedive as well.
Nosedive, yes. Now here's one.
Dogfight.
Actually, dogfight had been used earlier, a few years earlier, like the early 1900s, to mean any kind of dispute or feud. It was used for the first time during World War II to mean an air battle between two planes.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, not just about World War I words and phrases, but the language in general, because that's what we talk about when Pat joins us. 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. Vicki from Harlem is wondering about the military origins of the word snafu. That's not World War I, is it?
No, I think that's World War II. And it supposedly has an acronym, but I
which
I,
we can't say on the air.
Yeah, which we probably shouldn't say on the air.
Now, when I heard that you were doing this, I did look up words from World War I, and
isn't it amazing how many there are?
And some of the things that surprised me were things like a cushy job.
Yes. Now, cushy had been around before, but it was only used to mean a cushy job. Or a cushy sort of undertaking. Mm-hmm. Something easy was cushy. Now, in World War II, it came to mean comfortable or luxurious. I mean, World War I, I'm sorry. So that soldiers might talk of a cushy billet or a cushy operation, mm-hmm. something that was comfortable or easy in that sense.
Another word, ersatz.
Now, I didn't know that was World War I.
And then cold feet. He has cold feet.
Are you
scared.
Sure that's World War
I? Well, that was...
I know trench foot came yes. out of World War I.
A
I
lot
didn't
of
know
trench words.
Yeah.
We don't have trenches anymore, so...
We had an item on our blog once, Stuart and I, about trench warfare, and Stuart noted that...
This is your husband who
yes,
has collaborated
husband.
With you
yes.
on at least one book.
Yeah, yes. Actually, he's collaborated on all of them.
Uh-huh.
But
didn't get credit.
Right.
It's not Patricia T. O'Connor as told to Stuart Kellerman.
True. Stuart covered the war in Vietnam for UPI. He was a bureau chief in Saigon for a while. And he actually was in trenches with soldiers in Vietnam. And we had a reader who said, oh, there couldn't have been trenches in Vietnam. That's World War I. Mm-hmm. Now, Stuart would have remembered if he were in World War I. He has a very good memory. He wasn't in World War I. And we actually had pictures of him in trenches. But, no, there is still trench warfare in some places, I imagine, where there's hand-to-hand combat on the ground. But for the most part, trenches are a thing of the past. But another interesting feature, we should say, of trench warfare, interesting from a distance, is the word cooties, which mm-hmm. came out of World War I. Now, it started out actually as an adjective when cootie meant infested with lice. This was first recorded in 1915. And the phrase going cootie meant getting lice and being quarantined for the purpose of being loused, deloused. And later, cooties, the noun, plural usually, came to mean body lice later in the war. And it's believed that these two words, cootie and cooties, originally came from words for body lice in the languages of Maori and in Malay.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
Well, the English language, again, has been very welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
We have words from all over the world. But that is interesting. I guess we picked the ones that sound fascinating to us. Cootie.
Cootie.
Can you think of a better word to describe?
See, I always thought growing up that cooties just meant germs. It was sort of a funny word for germs.
No, we always thought it was little bugs that
little
you had to
bugs,
pull. Any kind of
anonymous
you got cooties,
bugs.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there are bugs
out there.
But
head lice was probably the most common
yeah.
kind of cootie.
Yeah, right.
Some of the other words that I found that we use all the time are mock-up.
Mm-hmm.
Push up the daisies.
Ah.
Draftee.
Uh-huh. Conscription was used for the first time in this sense.
Being in a funk, being in a bad mood.
Uh-huh.
Another one. Hush, hush.
Oh.
This was a very rich war for
it
words.
Was. And you know, the British got there before we did. So most of these interesting World War I terms actually came from the British, the Australians. And some were adopted from French into English.
So the Australians probably brought cootie because
they may have brought cootie from Maori or from Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, the Americans didn't really get in there with any of their war slang till the last minute because we didn't enter the war until 1917.
A listener wants to know if you know the origin of the word blimp.
That has to be a British word. It's a British word,
because
yes.
Colonel Blimp was that's a wonderful movie, by the way. Michael Powell's film, Colonel Blimp.
Oh, yeah? Well, I don't think there was a colonel. There was no one named Blimp,
mm-hmm.
At least in the manufacture of the first blimp. It's believed that the word is imitative. That is, it sounds like someone flicking his finger against an inflated blimp.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first theory that was recorded, and that was recorded during World War I, so it gets the most prominence, but no one really knows. But the blimp was a non-rigid airship. Its counterpart, the rigid skeleton airship, was the Zeppelin, which had been around since about the turn of the century, but it really didn't become a household name until the Germans started using it for bombing raids.
Mm-hmm. The Graf Zeppelin, of course, being one of the great tragedies in this country.
Yes, yes.
When it blew up.
The Hindenburg. Yeah.
Oh, the Hindenburg, right.
Right, right. That was a Zeppelin.
We will take a little break, and we will talk about more words from World War I or phrases, but also the language in general. Some of the people, things that I'm seeing from listeners have nothing to do with World War I. For example, a caller wants to know where the term "the life of Riley" comes from. I know the answer to that.
You do? Sure you do. Good.
But we will be back right after we take this little break. Stay with us.
Give to hear those three little words.
Ah, the velvet fog, reminding us that we're talking about language. More than three little words, as many words as we can jam into these conversations. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, whose books include Woe Is I, You Send Me,
Gone with the Wind.
Why not?
Origins of the Species.
Anna Karenina, War and Peace.
Right.
A lot of good books. You can also find her on gramophobia.com. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on Facebook at WN, and also on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And I mentioned earlier that a caller wanted to know where the term The Life of Riley comes from. It has nothing to do with World War One. It had to do with a radio show. William Bendix actually played Riley, and he took it very easy. He lived a very cushy life. So whenever somebody had a sinecure, they would say he lived a life of Riley. And it is interesting how those things come into the language, and then people still say the life of Riley and have no idea how that happened. Another caller wants to know about passport and wristwatch, which only existed after World War One.
Well, I don't think passports were required. I know that immigration documents weren't required until sometime after World War One.
So the World War One changed the culture of international relations.
It did.
And we're still going through that today, as we
but,
are
you know,
seeing.
I wanted to mention one interesting etymology, and this is the word tank, the armored artillery vehicle that really changed ground warfare. It was introduced in 1916 by the British, and when it was under development the year before, in 1915, they needed a code word for this machine that they had been referring to as a land cruiser or a land ship, and they chose the word tank out of the blue, and that was its code name. And so it was developed in secrecy. Then after it was introduced into the war, it came into the war during the Battle of the Somme. The name wasn't a secret anymore, and it stuck. But it was an ordinary word chosen at more or less at random.
Well, there you can see a tank as being some kind of a metal.
Right, a reservoir or container. That may have been the idea. And that word, incidentally, probably came from India, from Gujarati, ultimately from Sanskrit, where it was a word for a pond.
Then the Germans came up with the panzers.
Yes. The Germans, incidentally, more or less ignored tanks during World War One. They only had 20 of them, compared to thousands made by the French and the British.
A big mistake.
Well, yeah, they didn't believe tanks were going to be important in the war. Of course, they changed their minds in World War II.
Hmm. John from Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air. John?
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to talk about the change in the meaning of the word front in the First World War, where it became something that was actually mobile instead of describing a place on a building or an object.
Right. It was a movable sort of a battle interface.
Yeah, it's now they brought that forward now into weather and things
You're
like
right.
that. And the other term was wastage.
Oh. How did
which
that
is, well, you know, we all know there's an X amount of wastage in the production of product and materials and things like that. But it came to be a euphemism for the average, you know, the number of people who are killed along a static front every day during a battle.
That was wastage?
Or they referred to it as wastage.
Oh, my.
Well, we do have those weird things like collateral damage, things like that.
Sure.
Friendly fire.
Yeah.
We come up with things that don't sound like we killed that person.
Right. But you mentioned front. You know, the World War One was the first war for which we had the phrase home front to mean the people back home providing support.
Well, it's because it was the first one that they believed was a total war. It took the effort of an entire nation to fight.
Many entire nations.
Thank you so much for calling us.
Well, you're very welcome. Have a great day.
How did you know those things?
I got my degree in First World War history.
Oh. Well, I was expecting to hear Google.
Wikipedia.
When I was listening to Pat describe tank, I was thinking it's a water tank. That's why they use that word. It was because when you looked at it, it looked like a water tank that they would put on top of a building.
Right. Put tracks on it.
And then when they slapped tracks on it, but it could be passably looked at as a water tank.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much for calling.
So you.
And now we go to Ken from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. The word is strafe.
Oh, yes.
So you're familiar with that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which comes from the German. Can I attempt it?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
With the rolling R? Let's see if I get it.
Please do.
Oh, I can't do it.
Strafe.
Strafen.
Strafen.
Zu strafen.
Yeah, strafen.
Yeah,
the
to punish, yeah.
Strafe became a big word in English in World War I because of its use in Germany. The Germans had a popular slogan during World War I.
Yes.
Gott strafe England.
Strafe.
God punish England.
Yeah.
Strafen meant punish.
So were the English-speaking and the French-speaking combatants picking up words from their enemies?
Oh, yes, yes, that happened.
I mentioned ersatz. I guess strafe is another example.
Sure, right. And in English, strafe came to mean to attack with machine gun fire from a low-flying aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
But the British soldiers just adopted that word from the propaganda slogan used by the Germans. God punish England.
Derek from the Upper West Side, how are you on the air?
Hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Most famous phrase, I believe, from World War I was shell shocked.
Mm-hmm.
And it became known as battle fatigue in World War II.
Now PTSD.
In Vietnam.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, shell shock. That was first recorded in 1915. And it was a very misunderstood disorder. If you've read anything about it, it's quite sad the way shell-shocked soldiers were treated. A lot of them were treated like malingerers, or they were not given pensions, some of them, on their leaving the service, because it was felt that they had not met their, you know, duty to their country.
And Homer rephrased it as the thousand-yard stare in the Aeneid, which was a follow-up to Odysseus in the Iliad.
Right. There was a lot of, in photographs of many shell-shocked soldiers, they have this stare, this wide-eyed, empty stare on their faces.
It is interesting that Homer would have also recorded it.
Well,
I'm sure it went back way before.
It wasn't about shelling, necessarily. It was about the stress of battle.
Thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
It had an incredible impact on all sorts of other things. For example, one of the great English writers, Ford Madox Ford, was never the same because he had been shell-shocked in World War I. Things that happened, tinnitus was Louis Ferdinand Céline, who wrote novels, some pretty great ones, wrote them, he said, because he had tinnitus from his experiences in World War I, and he couldn't sleep. So stayed up at night, and he decided to write.
Right.
Now, a listener corrects me. I don't know if this is true, but it makes sense. A listener wrote about the origins of the life of Riley as an easy and pleasant life. It actually came from the Irish-American community of the United States in the early part of the 20th century. The first printed citation of that he found is from the Connecticut newspaper, the Hartford Courant, December 1911, in a piece headed "Bullet Ends Life of a Famous Wild Cow." Now, I guess if that's true, then when they did the radio show, The Life of Riley, they were picking up on that.
Yeah, maybe it was already established.
In the same way that Homeland picks up on something that we all know.
Well, in World War I, there were a lot of words and phrases that had existed beforehand but really weren't known and weren't mainstream, like the phrase cannon fodder, which had been in use, but it really wasn't popularized until World War I, when people started using it more. And the same with, there was a word scrounge, meaning to forage around and find things. And maybe even pilfer them. This came to the forefront in World War I when soldiers were scrounging and pilfering to keep fed. And now this is interesting, the word dud. A lot of people think that now we use dud to mean something ineffective because it comes from the meaning of an unexploded shell. Actually, it's the other way around. It meant something ineffective, a thing or a person that was ineffective or a failure.
And then we applied it to the shells?
Before World War I, then they started calling unexploded shells duds.
That's the incredible back formation.
Yes.
Let's take a call from Bob from Morristown. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm wondering when the usage of World War I came into play.
Oh, yeah.
I have a book of photographs that was published in 1923. It's a coffee table book. It's huge. And it's got, it's like 250 pages of photographs from that war.
Mm-hmm.
But it refers to it as the Great War.
Yes. Now, it's an interesting thing that you bring up because when it was, 1914 to 1918... we didn't know that there was going to be another one like it. So, of course, we didn't call it World War I. It was called originally, early on in 1914, it was called the Great War. It was also called the War That Will End War, which is a phrase of H.G. Wells. And it was called, toward the end of the war, it was called the First World War, meaning the First Worldwide War. Uh-huh. Now, it wasn't called World War I until Time magazine used that phrase in 1939 on the eve of World War II. They used it shortly after Germany invaded Poland and ushered in the next war. So Time magazine was the first to use the term World War I in print in September 11th. 1939, and the first to use World War I in print the following week.
A caller says that the phrase basket case also came from World War I in reference to people who sustained terrible injuries.
I didn't know that.
And Kitty from Yonkers, you think that a previous caller got it wrong?
Hello, yes. I just had some doubt about the notion that the phrase thousand-yard stare originated in Homer for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think it sounds like it was from a very good translation, an evocative translation, but I suspect that Homer didn't measure distances in yards, and that immediately sends my antennas up.
Yeah, well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Yards
but yes,
were Anglo-Saxon.
But I guess I don't know what the Greeks were using for measurement at that time.
I don't know either.
But the idea is the concept may very well have
been in
Homer. Yeah,
staring into the distance, yes.
Now, Pat, we were not able to get to all the calls or all the words, but you maintain a website that can handle all of that. You want to tell us about
yes,
it?
Yes,
in a very brief time?
Grammarphobia.com.
Now, make sure grammar, you spell grammar with M-M-A-R.
Right. And I'll answer any question you want to send me.
And then people also can send something specific about our show to you?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show again, Patricia T. O'Connor. Excuse me. I get all choked up when I mention her name.
Yeah, I know.
Author of numerous books about the language. And, Pat, it's always a lot of fun to talk with you on our show.
Thanks, Leonard.